And we are live. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm one of your co-hosts, Blake Ruffino. Alongside me is my counterpart and co-host, Joe De Leon. Good evening, good sir. How are you?
I am doing fantastic, Blake. I'm certainly probably doing better than you and LSU fans who seemingly found themselves in another fight. Lane Kiffin.
You know that I'm never going to back down from a fight. So these kinds of things never really bother me. I don't know if they necessarily bother you as much, but here's the question. Where did he lie? Here's why I keep asking Ole Miss fans and Ole Miss media.
Yes.
Did he lie?
What are you specifically referring to? What
in aspect of it? Obviously, Lane Kiffin made news today with Vanity Fair having a couple of comments, which, Joe, I don't know if you want me to read them or not. But coming right out of the gate, Lane Kiffin had a couple of comments today stating as much. Now, there were a lot of comments that were in there, but saying to recruits and recruits' families that no one said, hey, coach, or a lot of people said, hey, coach, we really like you, but my grandparents aren't going to allow me to come to Oxford. That just does not happen in Baton Rouge. He said that Ole Miss has a difficult time distancing themselves from the Confederate flag and the Colonel Rebel as well. And in Baton Rouge, that doesn't happen as well. So, Joe, I guess that was the thing in all of that that got taken out of it because of that specific quote. I guess people didn't read the entire article that was also in there. He also stated that no coach that he talked to ever really told him to stay at Ole Miss. So, yes, I understand the fight, but here's my question. How did Lane Kiffin in 6 months get committed and sign more five stars in 6 months than in 6 years at Ole Miss? So is it something that they were actually battling when he was able to do that in 6 months in Baton Rouge?
Well, the big thing that resonated with me, I understood what he was saying because with the first part about some recruits not feeling comfortable and their families not feeling comfortable with going to Oxford, living in Oxford and attending school in Oxford. He pointed it out in the statement that the day after he responded to the reporter and said, I know that this is going to get misconstrued, but it's shown in the demographics of people that live in Baton Rouge compared to Oxford. It's a lot more diverse in Baton Rouge. It doesn't mean anything's wrong with Oxford, but I think he was merely pointing out that some people from different parts of the country just might not feel totally comfortable going and living in Oxford, Mississippi. But the more thing that stood out to me, Blake, was the comment about none of the coaches that I talked to told me not to take the LSU job, to stay at Ole Miss.
I agree.
I mean, that was, I think, the biggest signal. And I think something that a lot of people were wondering, because we knew that Lane Kiffin had this really deep, very, very deep Rolodex of people that he could turn to and talk through this decision. It was brought up the entire time. All the great coaches that he probably spoke to about this, it sounds like they all agreed that, hey, go and take the job with the bigger brand that is going to give you more support. I always thought that was the one thing that was foregone the most by people that were upset at Lane Kiffin for making the decision, is that why stick somewhere where if things start to slowly regress, you end up like Stoops, you end up like James Franklin? Why not go somewhere where you're going to get emphatically supported?
Well, Neil McCready of Rebels 247 came out with a piece today just to read something that Neil stated in there. He said some stuff is perspective. The LSU coach's refusal to say Ole Miss, opting instead of for the last place in the previous place. He also brings up that Lane has been very calculated, but Lane did talk to Neil McCready today on 247, which you can go and read the article. By the way, Joe and I have an annual code that we can give you. It's RJ60. If you want to subscribe to your favorite team, Neil McCready over at Ole Miss is able to provide that for you, but it does seem that he did. Did you make the and so you can read some of that, but Kiffin's statement to Neil McCready is that none of my comments in the Vanity Fair were calculated. I wasn't trying to make a calculated move or ploy here. I was just saying what it was, the truth. And so, Joe, I'm not going to really hear on a national show really dive into that. I'll do that at 7 p.m. Central Standard Time, and I'll probably start yelling and get called a lot of really bad names. But here's the question that I was asking, and nobody will answer the question for me, as we're doing an LSU deep dive here tonight. I've been trying to prolong this as long as humanly possible because, well, you've been asking them like this, hold off. I don't want people thinking we're homers here.
Yeah.
How has he gotten committed and signed more five stars in 6 months than his entire time at Ole Miss? What I think he's also saying is that being at LSU from a recruiting standpoint is easier for me. And that was an uphill battle that we fought. You can get multiple players and recruits to tell you that they want to come to Ole Miss. But I asked the question over and over again, how are you able to get Jordan Seaton, Sam Levitt? I understand how you got Prince Will-Umiah-Mellon, but how are you able to get Corey Barber? How are you able to get Ahmad Hudson? How are you able to get all of these top-end guys more in 6 months than you did in 6 years? Can someone please answer that question for me?
Well, I think that the other part...
Hold on one second. When he left, Ole Miss people stated that they would spend just the same amount of money as LSU would. So they're going to have to concede one of them. Are you conceding the fact that Lane Kiffin and company are able to do things in reference in recruiting because it's LSU, which you admitted that couldn't happen in today's world? Or are you conceding that what he is saying has some truth to it? Because one of the two you're going to have to concede, Joe.
Well, so the other part with this that I think that it automatically is the way that he framed it and the things that he brought up with the demographics of people that are in Oxford, Mississippi, that like that aspect of it was going to piss a lot of people off. But the other part with this too, and you mentioned how did he get all these top commits to come to LSU as quickly as he did when he stepped foot on campus in Baton Rouge, the recruiting pool as well. That's the other part with this that like I lean into more. I feel like it's probably harder to convince kids from outside of the state of Mississippi to want to come into the state of Mississippi. And you're not going to have really very many five stars ever. While you were talking, I was trying to pull and see on 24/7 Sports some of the highest rated kids over the past couple of years. And TK Keys was the highest rated, the only five star that I could find in the past 3 years. And he chose to go to Tennessee. But to this whole point, like there's not as many kids to pull from. And it seems like, and this has always been something in the whole world, the zeitgeist of college football that's been brought up for decades on why Ole Miss and Mississippi State can't have long-term sustained success, is that it's really hard to recruit kids to come into the state, and there's not very many kids in the state that you can pull from that are elite high-end recruits. This is all stuff we're kind of relitigating things that we talked about on why he chose to leave in the first place. He just opened an old wound that seemingly we thought was healed, and now we're back to square one with yelling over why he left.
Well, hold on. Let's understand something, too, before we move on here. Here's what he didn't say. He didn't say that he hated his time in Oxford. He didn't say that Oxford was a crappy place. He didn't say that Oxford didn't change his life. Actually, all of the opposite things is what he said. But we can't take two things, or we try to take everything and say, oh, he said that he liked Oxford and he needed Oxford from a family perspective, that he needed Oxford for a perspective of making him a better person. It doesn't change the fact that his statements were no coaches told him to stay there. It doesn't change the fact. I mean, by the way, the best head coach of all time, if you got to wonder, literally went on College game day every day and stated as much. Mm-hmm. He stated as much every single day. So then you go to a situation as well about the recruiting piece. So he's already stated, by the way, in his introductory press conference, while coming in at LSU, he said that I needed Oxford and Ole Miss before more than it needed me. He's conceding that point while still being at LSU. He still says that in the press conferences today that I'm at, by the way. I'm at every one of them. He still says it. But he also can say, hey, what were struggles that you had in recruiting at Ole Miss that don't plague you at LSU? And he says that, and we're supposed to, people are supposed to say, oh, well, he's taking a shot. What is he supposed to say? If that is a problem, then he can't tell the truth? Everybody, look, let me tell you the biggest thing, the biggest lie about Lane Kiffin as someone who's been around him for the last 6 months. The biggest lie is that the perception of him on and off the field. Because on the field and in recruiting, he's a completely different human being. And I've seen it. So regardless of if he's telling the truth or not, are you going to sit there and tell me that a school, by the way, you had a former running back who stated in 2015 that they're getting off the bus and there are massive altercations while they're getting off the bus, and I will leave it there. He was on with Jalen Collins and all of those guys on their podcast when he stated it. So again, I just bring up the simple nature of, can you make a statement that is factual and still other things that I've stated along the way also is factual?
Yeah, I think that what's kind of surprising me, the reaction to this is I feel like there's like a denial on some of the things that he's pointed out of, again, it should be a no-brainer, the diversity difference between Baton Rouge and Oxford. I don't understand why that's such a controversial thing to point out. Now, I think that he kind of took it a degree further to imply that those in Oxford, Mississippi are, he kind of, the way that he framed it, to a degree, play devil's advocate here, the way that it was framed made it seem like Oxford, Mississippi is like a really crappy place and that the people there are not, they're not welcoming. That was the way that it came off. And I don't think that that's what he was trying to say.
But
it's Lane Kiffin. He says things and it always comes off as him being grimy, him taking a shot, him trying to get another knife twist in when he gets the chance to. He can't say things without it being construed that way. Because no, like can't. As it is, and this is negative towards Lane Kiffin, is that he has always, because of the way that he communicates and that he is very, very tactile with the way that he says things and the way that he operates, you never know what he's trying to do. You never know if he's being sincere. And it was said in the article, you never know if he's being sincere or if he's doing a bit or if he's acting. So when he makes a statement like this, automatically it's going to come off like he's taking a shot, even though he might not have been intending to do so.
Yeah, I mean, and I completely agree with you on that because of, again, the perception of whomst he is. Again, I will state, is it more plausible that what he is saying is the truth and that people had concerns, or is it less plausible? Because that's the real question that you have to ask. Is what he is saying plausible? Because if what he is stating is plausible, well, Joe, I mean, then we have a real question on our hands that we have to ask ourselves. But nevertheless, we will do an LSU deep dive on the actual football side of things. There is more college football reform. We are streaming live on the 24/7 Sports Twitter page. Do us a favor, since we are there, hit that retweet button. Joe, you need to do it yourself. Hit that retweet button as well. We're glad to be partnered with our good friends over at 24/7 Sports. With that being said, we already brought up our good friend Neil McCready and what he's doing over at Rebels 247. Wherever and whatever team that you follow, you can go over to 24/7 Sports today and get an annual membership, VIP membership, from Joe and I. A promo code of RJ60 gets you 60% off of that annual VIP membership. Do you like LSU? Do you like Ole Miss? Who is your team and you need to get over to that platform? I know that recruiting is starting to hit up and heat up all around the country. So if you want a 60% off annual VIP membership, use that promo code RJ60 at checkout so you'll get that 60% off. Also, even though we're glad to be part of it, for good friends over at 24/7 Sports, do us a favor by hitting the like and share it. Subscribe down below if you're on YouTube as well. Joe, it feels like this offseason, as we start transitioning here, it does feel like this offseason is getting closer as we get into August. And look, we're only a couple of months away. June is going to be right around the corner before you know it. And we'll really start getting into football season here. So it's not that far away for everything that's to be told. However, changes around the college football continue. And today, or really Friday, Brandon Marcello of CBS Sports came out with an article, Joe, that I think is one of the wildest things in the last 5 years of college football, as there are multiple things that are being discussed around the White House. In some of the things in some of the latest college football reform that have been discussed, it is stated that the White House is, quote unquote, seeking input from industry participants, but potential coaches, salary caps, their own G6 playoff, along with antitrust. But I think the biggest thing that is coming out of this new college football reform is that over the next 2 years, they are proposing a college sports reform task force that will have limited antitrust exemptions to make rules on college football that will also override state laws. So, Joe, as this continues, what are your thoughts on the growing interest from the White House to try to help college football and where they currently are? And I got to be honest with you, this college sports reform task force scares the bejesus out of me. But how do you feel first?
I disagree with that, Blake. I think that it was a white paper that was published, that was put together, that had a lot of concepts. These are not concepts that are
being enacted.
They're not being enacted like, oh, this is what's going to happen, we're moving forward. These are suggestions. And as you pointed out, they're looking for increased input from industry participants. So players, coaches, administrators, whatever it might be, in order to help refine this thing. I really encourage everybody to go over to CBS Sports and read the piece written by Brandon Marcel. It was very well done, because there was a ton of stuff in here. There was a lot in here. We're probably not going to get to all of it. These are the things that stood out to me the most in the three-phase plan. And I think some of these bits need to be emphasized in whatever new regulatory body is built to help fix college athletics. I think that the salary caps for coaches and administrators is something that we do need. I think that it has become a ridiculous part of the sport that makes it, and actually not the sport, college athletics in general, that makes it look like a complete and utter dysfunctional mess, that coaches are being paid upwards of $40, $50 million to not coach. Mm-hmm. Ross Dellinger published something today that I want to double check what it was related to, but the concept of capping salaries based on only athletic revenue so that you can't have donors contribute to coaches' salaries, I think that that's one very unique way, original way, in order to get things at bay, because schools are not going to go overboard and give out ridiculous contracts with huge buyouts if they don't have donor backing. But Blake, the one bit that caught my attention the most was the concept in phase three to put together a permanent governing body that would include all the conference commissioners, Notre Dame's athletic director, whoever it is at the time, it would be Pete Bevacqua currently, two representatives from other conferences, one rep from D2 and D3, an independent rep and an attorney, as well as players. But it was also brought up that there would be individual commissioners for every single sport. Mm-hmm. This is the first time somebody has put that down and written that down on something like this, Blake. So that's the one thing that I'm actually happy about. I'm not scared about any of this stuff, because finally somebody put it out there in a structured plan to fix college athletics is having a commissioner. How many times have we said that on the show, Blake?
I agree with you. So I was going to get to that. I completely agree with you on phase three. However, we have got to back up. We got to talk about phase one first. Here's why. The reason we have to talk about phase one first is because they're seeking input from industry leaders. So if they take this clip that we're about to talk about and they utilize it, I hope they listen and do this. You cannot give a forum, you cannot give a governing body the outright unlimited power to make changes for college athletics, how they stand. Do you want to know how I know? Look at what's going on. Commissioners, TV execs, et cetera, have had unlimited power to do exactly what they've wanted. They wanted to expand the playoff, they expanded it. They wanted to do different portal windows, they've done it. You cannot do a situation where you're given a task force unlimited, and this is their words, an unlimited antitrust exemption to make changes to college athletics because what if they get it wrong? By the way, this is only a two-year window. We are in college athletics now in the NIL and transfer portal era where there's a lot of player movement and expanded playoff, and we've only been doing this for 5 years, and things continue to change. Now, you could say if you put a governing line down and you put specific rules in place, it will calm things down. I don't want for the federal government to have, and again, I just want to completely state this, unlimited antitrust exemptions so that they can mold college football in their image. Who are these 15 people that they're going to hire? Because in that specific part of phase one, and to give a governing body 15, and I quote this, 15 people, unlimited antitrust exemptions, is not going to work. You know how I know why they're already doing it? Let's go to phase two. Phase two, there was a conversation around Cody Campbell, who is the massive booster around Texas Tech. And what did Cody Campbell state? That 70 to 75, if not a little bit more teams, need to pull all of their media resources so that everybody is making the same. No duh.
Media rights.
Media rights, excuse me. Thank you.
Yeah.
No duh, you want to do that. No duh. Because Texas Tech isn't making the same as Notre Dame. Texas Tech isn't making the same as Alabama or Ohio State or Oregon or LSU or Florida. Of course you want to bring that together. And him having the president's ear, him being a massive part of this, giving a guy who's got a boatload of money with a school that does not have the TV right deals that other teams in big conferences like the SEC and Big Ten have, I don't trust that. I don't trust that as far as I can throw it. So if they're going to put a situation together where you're giving somebody unlimited antitrust exemptions, meanwhile, the guy that's been, has a massive voice in this, wants everybody put their media rights together, no doubt you want to. Because Texas Tech does not get the same viewership as Alabama or Notre Dame. Why would I want to lump all of those together? Why should you? So, Joe, as much as I agree with you, which me and you are on the same exact page about phase three, phase one and phase two have massive problems to it that you can't even come close to enacting here.
Well, okay. I agree with you on phase two being like it's a whole own separate part of this. I have been against pooling media rights because if you try to structure a plan around pooling media rights, it is going to fall apart in an instant.
Yes.
When this whole discussion happened, we had it months ago when they were potentially going to amend legislature in order to make it so that they could amend media rights. It was very obvious that the Big Ten and the SEC were not going to comply with this. They weren't. They just right. They have no interest to. Just like you said that no duh, Cody Campbell is an advocate for this because he and like many of the other programs across the country, like the Big 12 and the ACC, where teams are pretty mediocre across the board, they would be more than happy to be a part of a larger media rights deal that would bring in a lot more money and would raise their floor.
Right.
But when you have conferences like the SEC and the Big Ten that are making significantly more money than the media rights deals for the Big 12 and the ACC, there is zero reason for them to buy into this. So forget the concept of pooling media rights. I think that just trying to pitch this and trying to move this forward, it is going to stall because the two most powerful people that are going to be a part of all these things, that all these, oversight governing body would have Petitti, it would have Sankey in it. We have seen how quickly and aggressively they have put their foot down and completely stopped changes and growth and progression because it does not fit their interests. So I don't understand why the media rights bit had to be a part of it. I agree with you on that part. I think phase one has good aspects to it, but the pooling of media rights, I don't think is anything to do with fixing the future of college athletics. I don't think that it does whatsoever.
Tell me how phase one and overriding state laws has any, I don't want to say any benefit. Can someone tell me what the benefit is? Because the real truth of this is that states are allowed to make laws in their own states. You can't come in here and say that we're going to give an unlimited amount of antitrust and say we're just going to say what we want to do and this is the bottom line because we said so. That's not how this is supposed to work. It's not how, I mean, I'm not trying to get political here, but I don't trust Cody Campbell. I don't trust the commissioners. I don't trust coaches because everybody is out for their own interests. So you're going to give these people an unlimited amount of antitrust limitations to where they can view and do anything that they want? That overriding state laws do what now? Like, am I losing my mind? I mean, someone please explain to me how phase one has anything good to it. It doesn't.
Well, no. Okay, no, that I disagree with. There is a lot of good that is in phase one. The concept of phase one is that you would need antitrust exemption in order for this to go through. And I understand what you're saying, but I think that the concepts of one, this was brought up, of adjusting conference memberships for the non-revenue sports, because there's zero reason for softball to Monmouth softball should be able to go to Rutgers and be in the same
conference. No reason Stanford should and Miami should be playing in the same conference. I agree.
Right. Rutgers should be playing Monmouth regularly. They should not be playing Oregon. It doesn't make any sense. The other part with this is I stand by in phase one. Capping coaches' salaries is the biggest unnecessary expense in college athletics, and it is weighing it down. And I think that not only does it create a gigantic, exorbitant expense, it also weighs down effective decision-making in the degree that so much attention is focused on hiring and firing the next coach and navigating around that, that there is not better intention put around actually administering at their athletic departments. I think that it is a huge anchor that is holding back athletics, college athletics. I also think that the other part with this that was very, very intriguing to me, the NBA has the Bird Rule, which is a part of their contracts, which is an incentive for guys to stay put where they are. If you stay somewhere for consecutive seasons, you can make more money. I think that something like that, putting that in place, which has been tied to stuff that we've brought up before, having multi-year contracts, which is kind of hard to do because you don't want to completely restrict player movement, because if for whatever reason a kid has a parent that's sick and they want to get closer to home, maybe something goes wrong that with their personal lives and they just need to uproot themselves from where they are. Maybe a kid wants to change freaking majors and he's not really playing and he wants to be able to go somewhere else, whatever it might be. I think that a concept like this to provide incentives for kids to stay is also a good concept. I get where you're stuck on, but I think that a lot of the other bits that were pitched here are really good starting points for solving a lot of issues that are plaguing college athletics.
I don't hate the college, or I don't hate the coach's salary. Okay. I would rather do it based off of a percentage, but can I just ask a humble question here? Okay. If teams in the SEC and Big Ten are making $150 to $200 million a year, and a coach who is really in college, coaches are the real superstars long term, right? Like Kirby Smart has been a superstar in college football for a long time. Lane Kiffin, Dan Lanning, you name Marcus Freeman is a massive superstar. Players in college come and leave. So if Notre Dame makes $250 million a year for football and you're giving Marcus Freeman 13 of that per year, is that really, I mean, is that an egregious amount? Now, you're talking about the buyouts, and I don't disagree with you about the buyouts. There needs to be something in reference to the buyouts, in reference to not making those so large. And that I completely agree and would go down that rabbit hole. But if teams are going to make 150, and most conferences now in the SEC and Big Ten are making somewhere around $70 to $75 million a year from just TV rights alone, someone's going to have to tell me how in the world that we see that as a problem for a coach to make $10 million a year when he's the CEO of that specific ship?
Well, first of all, the amount of money that a program brings in, the operating expenses are, they're high. Well, they're very, very high.
Hold on. Pause. They're high because they're having to give everybody else money from their specific school for their specific universities. So, for an example, if LSU football is making 150 or 100, it was actually 162 million. Well, a lot of that money went to other revenue streams that aren't generating money, which isn't fair to them. So, I get what you're saying. The reason I went from a gross perspective there is because he's still the CEO of that operating expense.
Yes, but I'm not even talking about having to split that money that you're making with the Olympic sports, the non-revenue sports. The operating expenses, regardless, are still very, very high for a lot of the top programs. I think that if you put putting a salary cap on something like this isn't, oh, well, you can only make $2 million. That's not how I see this. I think that
that's why I think they should be a percentage. Instead of a fixed number, you need to do a percentage based off of the gross operating expense of that sport.
So that's why the concept of it only the money coming from athletic revenue, that's where I think that we should support this. Because, I mean, quite frankly, you have a lot of the top athletic departments that maybe they have big alumni bases. For the most part, like Kirby's contract is earned because they bring in so much money. Notre Dame, Marcus Freeman's contract is earned because they bring in so much money from their success. I think that if you tie it to that, it prevents from any ridiculously... The problem why a lot of these coaches' contracts are so high, Blake, is because there is donor involvement.
Agreed.
There are donors that when they're in the hiring cycle and they're trying to ramp things up and make a guy decide, a donor will step in and they will effectively influence that coach by putting more resources, putting more money towards their salary. And again, like I brought up at the beginning, it's why buyouts have been so large and why a lot of times when alumni bases, they're pissed off, these donors are pissed off when a coach is performing poorly, that they're the ones who end up ponying up the money and putting money on the table. Like who fired Jimbo? Oil money fired Jimbo. It was a very rich donor who fired Brian Kelly. The athletic department couldn't justify paying $50 million for his buyout. They would have looked ridiculous in, you know, if there was an audit of how money was spent within the athletic department. So I think that the problem is with this is that you need to remove donor intervention from a lot of things. That's the whole concept with this that I think that they need to keep moving forward. But I think that there are bits and pieces, again, with phase one that work. I think that we do need to find at least a way to rein in coaches' salaries, because when we start giving up a million guarantees because Jimmy Sexton dominates and manipulates every single negotiation, that then we're just going to keep going down a worse and worse path.
I don't disagree, but here's another thing that I would just bring up.
Okay.
See, here's where they're getting me here. In reference to the conferences and them having power to realign non-revenue generating sports, where I think that is a logical point in step. It's a very logical point in step. I still go back. You can have good points, but the main one being bad. Do we want a governing body with the federal government that has congressional oversight to have the rules and regulations to determine what can and cannot happen? Because that's the number one point.
We need something. Sure. We can't keep operating this way. We need something. Someone has to be in charge.
Okay, sounds good. Then don't have the ability to change state laws and don't put in there that you have an unlimited exemption for antitrust. You can't do that.
I don't remember exactly where that was in the article, and I don't remember.
It's literally sentence three. It's like literally one of the first things that gets brought up. So, I mean, if we want to bring that up, and they want to clarify exactly what it is that they're talking about there, then by all means do it. But the biggest thing in all of this article comes down in the first couple of sentences when it talks about them having, and I quote, an unlimited antitrust exemption.
Wait, no. This says armed with limited antitrust exemptions in the authority.
Well, then it got edited because I have the quote right here. It says unlimited antitrust exemptions. Well,
I will agree with you. The authority to override state laws, I think, does complicate things to a major degree.
Well, then that's unlimited. So you can put limited or unlimited. If an unelected, hold on 1 second. If an unelected body in the federal government, non-elected officials have the right to change state laws, then that is unlimited because you would have to go into 50 states and change them. That is egregious.
Well, we do need to have universal national NIL laws in order to make this better. I think that the word that you had meant to emphasize was it would carry permanent antitrust protection. So that the minute that this would come through, that it would be permanently protected, that there would be no way to go back on it. That to me is more dangerous. That to me is the most dangerous aspect here, is that while antitrust protection is needed, the fact that it can never be questioned, that is where this ends up becoming something absolute that does end up leading to a slippery slope. I hope that that wouldn't be the case, but Blake, at the end of the day, somebody needs to be in charge.
I agree. But here's the last thing I'd say. Why does it run for 2 years when the president then gets out of office? And why did you put it in there that it can't be changed after you leave office?
Wait, say it again?
So if you read the 2-year rule, it says that this will be that committee will be brought together for 2 years. And in 2 years, the president leaves. He will leave office. And why is it that you're putting in place that these things can't be changed because you, from a political standpoint, you don't want them to be changed because you want to put the rubber stamp on it that I was the one that fixed it. And that is a scary and yet slippery slope to stand on, that, like you just stated, that things can't be changed as the world evolves.
I don't know. We'll see what comes of this, but I think that this is the most constructive outline for fixing college athletics that I've seen. I'm supporting this for the current moment. I think that there's bits and pieces, because this is obviously not the permanent plan. I think changes need to be had, and I think a lot of people are going to speak up on making these changes. But this is the best starting point that I've seen, because normally when these ideas get pitched, they're pretty stupid. They are not being pitched by people that are close enough to the situation to effectively know how to adjust and to handle these things. So
I agree with you. And that's why for 5 years, Congress has done nothing. And you want to give them oversight? The people who have had the rights to change and fix things haven't done it in 5 years. So now you want to give them oversight?
I don't know.
Okay. All right. Let's move on here. Oh, man. LSU fans are going to be mad at me when I say this. I've kind of been dreading this segment because of just this. Oh, wait. No, we're doing the U.S.
Notre Dame, USC. Notre Dame.
Okay. Let's get to that last. Joe, USC versus Notre Dame, per the LA Times, is having conversations of renewing the very anticipated rivalry. Your thoughts on USC and Notre Dame going back to the drawing board and trying to come back and put this game back together again?
Well, this was kind of understood that when there was a pause placed, that this wasn't going to be permanent. It was brought up by both sides that they were going to reignite negotiations and they were going to get back on track. It was pointed out that this rivalry would likely not return until 2030. So we're going to be deprived of this game for some time. Hey, maybe a break will be nice. Maybe it'll make Notre Dame and USC realize that they do appreciate each other and they do need one another. But like, here's the bit here. I think that we'll be fine. I think that the game is probably going to get back to normal, because the sticking point with this was because USC was negotiating in incredibly bad faith. And I brought this up when we were yelling about this last time, is that they were trying to say that they had to play the game at the very beginning of the season when Notre Dame had already set their schedule for 2026. There was no way that they were going to be able to make adjustments at the last second, nor were they going to get the waiver for week zero. It has been discussed multiple times, the potential move up for the football calendar to start in week zero instead of it starting in week one. So that would create an opening for everybody to play games that weekend, for Notre Dame to play USC. I still think it's incredibly soft that USC is operating from the premise that they would like to play this game at the beginning of the year because they're fearful of the committee holding them accountable if they lose to Notre Dame. I also think it's really lame and soft that USC does not want to play a tough game to finish off the season when most of the country is playing some of their toughest opponents, many of which are playing the hardest game on their schedules the final week of the season during rivalry weekend. And it only happens for you once every 2 years because you are too afraid to play in the cold in South Bend, so you have to play the games in South Bend in October. Blake, I think that we're going to be fine here, though, is the main bit, because Notre Dame probably will be comfortable with playing this game in the first month of the year. The reason why they couldn't do it is because of the difficult nature of USC trying to force them to change their schedule at the very last moment.
Again, not to get back into a yelling match on this, because I'm about to go after USC as well, because I do think what they're doing here is incredibly soft on this one. I have defended USC from start to finish on this because I understand where they're coming from. But the words that you just stated is a little bit too harsh for this specific reason. You don't want to play us at the last game at the end of the year. Yeah, they have another rival that's in their conference. And I don't understand Notre Dame and Notre Dame fans to understand that. Also, you're right. When they're in the heart of a season versus Ohio State, Oregon, and others, Indiana included, yes, they don't want to have to go over and play Notre Dame when you get to play Navy and Charleston State.
For the hundredth time, the USC schedule is not like an insanely difficult gauntlet, and Notre Dame's playing the G5 All-Stars. That is such a mischaracterization of the differences between their schedules. Like, forget if USC's playing a harder schedule or not. If you're as good as you think that you can be, it should be anytime, anywhere for facing Notre Dame.
Really? Yes,
the Notre Dame USC game has marked the winner of it setting up to win national championships.
Okay, well, first off, no, it hasn't, because Notre Dame hasn't won a national championship since the 80s. So let's calm down on that.
Wait, hold on. What do you mean, no, it hasn't? It absolutely, just because they haven't won a national championship USC since 1988. Also, in the 2000s, in the Pete Carroll era, there were instances when Notre Dame was highly ranked and USC beat Notre Dame, and it set them, I recall correctly, the Bush push game.
That's 20 years ago. That's 2 decades ago. It's 2 decades.
College football's been around for over 150. That's my point. It's a rivalry. That's important.
You keep saying, if you think it's good, you think you're as good as you are. You talk about, if your schedule is just a little bit tougher. Joe, USC plays Oregon, Penn State, Ohio State, and Indiana. Do you want me to tell you the teams that you don't play? You have one top 25 opponent.
But the argument isn't comparing schedules. The argument's not comparing schedules.
No, that's not what we're doing. Because they have 9 conference games against potentially 4 playoff teams where you have to go up against one. So, yes, they're having conversations on when to play it, where to play it. Do you want them to play it? So USC plays Ohio State, and then they play Indiana. Do you want to put them Notre Dame in the middle of that? That's what you're asking.
That's not what I'm asking.
You said to put it at the end, more at the end of the year, or where it was.
Rivalry weekend. It should be in rivalry weekend, or it should be in October when they normally play it.
Do you want them to go up against Ohio State, Indiana, Maryland, and then Notre Dame? Because it's not fair.
Maryland's real tough. Maryland's a real tough opponent. Real scary opponent.
You have the second last week because it's Navy. Not necessarily a tough opponent. Now, Hold on.
No. Can you stop just constantly just bringing up, Notre Dame plays Navy. They don't play Navy 11 times. They don't play Navy 11 times.
But at the same time, Notre Dame fans keep saying X, Y, and Z about conferences when you've never been in one. That's just the truth. Now,
Notre Dame fans aren't saying anything about conferences. They're saying that
because you don't understand it. You're saying play us because it's a rivalry game. They're saying, yeah, sure, but you're going to have to do it in the beginning of the season, even if you don't want to, because we have 9 conference games. And by the way, no, they don't want to. No one's going to want to sandwich a national championship contender in between Ohio State and Indiana. Nobody in the country is going to want to do that. You know how I know? Because Georgia and Florida State and Indiana themselves are canceling games. And hold on. Nobody says anything about Indiana scheduling 5 G6 teams.
Not related. It's not related.
Everybody else is doing it, but USC is taking the brunt of it. Now, hold on. I've been defending them. But I'm about to. This comes off as is that you hear that there's going to be a 24-team playoff and the game doesn't really matter. So now you're coming in and saying, okay, we'll play you.
It has never been that they don't want to play them. So I kind of disagree with that. I kind of disagree.
Relatively speaking, with a 2014 playoff that is on the table, now they have room for Notre Dame. Now the argument for an expansion is that because you go to 24 teams, teams will schedule tougher opponents because a potential loss doesn't bother them. That is what the expansion-favored Pea Party is going to say. Well, look at USC and Notre Dame want to get back at it. It does come off to me that USC sees an expanded playoff, and all of a sudden they're saying, hey, ho, we'll do it now. But at the same time, as I've stated about USC, this isn't just a Notre Dame thing. It's not just a Notre Dame cancellation. They also try to cancel against LSU. They've also canceled games that are also in the future. This isn't we don't want to play Notre Dame. This is, we have Penn State, Oregon, Ohio State, Indiana, and you're asking us to go up against another national title contender when that said national title contender doesn't have to do the same thing. Joe, it does come off as that they're talking out of both sides of their mouth, but I would tell Notre Dame, you don't understand this right now because you don't have to go through the same things that we do.
Again, I completely reject the notion that Notre Dame is playing a G5 schedule. I think that it is.
I didn't say they're playing a G5. Schedule now,
but I don't think that there's much. The middle to back end of the Big Ten is equally as weak as the middle. The ACC opponents that Notre Dame is going to face in the future after this upcoming season, and we already did this before. I pulled Notre Dame's upcoming opponents, and we had this debate, and I proved that Notre Dame has not far off of an equally competitive schedule with what they built with the ACC opponents that they have and multiple SEC and Big Ten opponents that they have. Yes. Do you want me to pull it up again and do this again?
Yes. You know how I can do it? Oregon, Ohio State, Indiana. You have Miami. So if you're going to
2026, I'm saying no, after this season.
That's what this is about. Do you think that they're not going to continue to play those teams in their own conference? I mean, I'm sorry. You have a one-year deal where you may play Bama. You have a one-year deal where you may play A&M. Sounds cute. They're having to play these teams every single year.
Yeah, you're right. They have to play these teams every single year. You're right. Notre Dame doesn't have to play any Big Ten opponents like when they play Purdue in 2027 and Michigan State in 2027.
They play the four main big boys in the Big Ten. Yes or no?
They not on a consistent basis, but they have scheduled rivalries with them. They do or matchups with them. They have scheduled matchups with Michigan. They have scheduled matchups with Alabama, with Texas, and with Clemson, and with Florida State.
A one-year sample size when you're saying, hey, we're going to play these four teams.
I'm literally like clicking through every schedule that they have until 2030, and I'm naming schools that are on these schedules.
You're naming one game, and I'm giving you 4 every single year. Until you can start giving me 4 to 5 every single year, please stop.
Okay, wait. Here's 2027. I can't believe we're doing this again. 2027, they play Auburn. Their schedule is – they have a bunch of openings in their schedule, to be perfectly clear. They play Auburn. They go to Clemson. They play Virginia Tech. And they play BYU. Those are
And none of that is tougher than Oregon, Ohio State, at Indiana, at Penn State.
I didn't say that it was. Didn't say that it was tougher, Blake. But I'm pointing out that they're facing highly competitive opponents. Those are all teams that Virginia Tech could be highly ranked. There's a strong chance.
Oh my gosh!
What are you talking about? Oh, so if when Virginia Tech is in a ranked ACC team in 2 years, like, are we just going to forego that I made that statement?
No. Three of those teams are consistently in the Final Four. Indiana State just won back-to-back national titles, and you're sitting here trying to tell me that it's the same.
They don't play those teams every single season, though. They got a tough draw for this one particular upcoming year.
And because Notre Dame's not in the conference, you don't realize that historically that's what it's going to look like. The strong chance of you playing Oregon, Ohio State, and Indiana and them being on your schedule is very high.
They have a scheduled matchup. Look, we have to get to the LSU preview because we put it in the title. We said we were going to get to it. I think that you're wrong about this.
Says the Notre Dame homer.
Beat Notre Dame. If USC and Lincoln Riley didn't have a track record of deliberately canceling tough matchups, then this would be a completely different discussion. What gave us the evidence.
What's the difference in Lincoln doing it versus Kurt Cignetti? There's not a difference.
But we shouldn't be enabling Kurt Cignetti, though. We shouldn't be enabling him.
This comes up, nobody brings up Cignetti.
Okay, we've got a short amount of time to get the LSU preview in, so let's try to get to it.
I've obviously talked a lot about LSU, but Joe, as we continue on our deep dive here, we continue to break down teams going into the 2026 season. I have, from a national perspective, because I talk about it every single night, have been dreading this because people continue constantly coming into the chat calling me a homer because we're talking about LSU. I'm going to let you take the floor here. As we continue on this path, breaking down teams in 2026, we go to Baton Rouge. What are your thoughts going into 2026 for the LSU Tigers?
Blake, plain and simple, looking at this roster, looking at what Lane Kiffin constructed, this is an incredibly boom or bust team for 2026. I know that there's an expectation and a hope that LSU, the floor is risen, that they are establishing a really good foundation for year one. But as I have dug in deeper into evaluating and breaking down the tape of some of these guys that are 2027 draft prospects, I have uncovered more and more players that have a lot of potential, but a number of which that have question marks and have a lot of work. Prince Wilumami Ellen was a very productive edge rusher a year ago. He needs a lot of work as a run defender, and you're expecting him to be a starting defensive lineman for you this upcoming year. You have Jordan Seaton, who has the potential, and Umami Ellen has a lot of potential to be a great player. Jordan Seaton has the potential to be a top 10 pick, but he needs to prove that he can maintain being in really good shape during the course of the season and play a lot more consistently, because for every great game that he had games like the Utah game where he really, really struggled and he got his ass beat. Sam Levitt is incredibly talented. He could be a first-round quarterback. But there's also instances on film where he makes brutal mistakes and he also can't stay fully healthy. Blake, I think that this team has a lot of potential because you have a lot of guys that are premier elite players. But the issue is that we've got talent that needs to be actualized. These guys need to develop and they need to develop quickly. Like, I'm bought in for what Lane Kiffin can do, and I've said this multiple times, but I really believe that there is going to be a potential bottoming out if things do not go according to plan, if some of these guys don't end up living up to expectations.
Bottoming out in what perspective?
I'm not saying that they're going to go 4-8, but I would say bottoming out is a 7-5 season, which is what you just did a year ago. LSU's too good of a football program to do worse than that.
I don't think that that's their floor. I would go a game above that and saying 8-4 would be their floor. However, the individualized talent that this team has, as I've been at every single practice that they've allowed for the full practices, I am shocked about how much individual talent they do have. Joe, they have boatloads of individualized talent. We went through a spring where we didn't see Sam Levitt. To be honest with you, I think the best receiver on the field at any given moment was Eugene Wilson, who was also held out for the spring. That wide receiver room, that running back room with Harlan Berry and Dylan Jones, who is the big emerging star coming out of spring, tagging him with Harlan Berry, an offensive line who the last 2.5 weeks lined up and said, "You're going to let us run the ball and there's nothing that you can do about it, and watch us." Felt more like LSU than LSU ever did under Brian Kelly, besides probably the 2 years under Jaden Daniels. They lined up and ran the football right at this team and said, "Stop us," and they didn't. I think that LSU, without question, you could say, well, Blake, they should be more talented. They have a $40 million roster. Well, they do have a $40 million talent roster, because I think Jordan Seaton, who has changed his body, has done a fantastic job. Joe, I think Winnie Watkins, Tre'Davious Green, probably the biggest riser at receiver, Trey Harris, along with others, showed that they can play. But, man, this defense is also really good. Last year, going into the season for LSU, I said that I thought that they were going to be a top 30 defense. They finished at 28th. That was with an offense who couldn't barely get past the 50-yard line. Well, Joe, a lot of those pieces return. You have Deshaun Spears returning. You have P.J. Woodland returning. You have D.J. Pickett, who was the number one corner coming out of high school, returning. I think the biggest steal in the portal was Ty Benefield. Joe, I think he's a bona fide All-American, and I think Jake Olsen hit another one, just like they did in the secondary last year with A.J. Halsey and with Mansoor Delane. I think their linebacker room is the most experienced in the country. You know how I know? Well, they have more tackles than anybody in the country combined, and it's not remotely close, with T.J. Dottery and Whit Weeks. I think Jordan Ross, who's a former five-star, has a lot of God-given ability, and you've already brought up Princeville. But I still think that there are some issues that this team has. I do think this team lacks a little bit of depth. And it's exactly what you would think about a team in a year one under a coach. What people see is that they spent $40 million on a roster and don't understand that there could be a level of depth concerns. With that being said, Joe, I think their quarterback room and Hassan Longstreet this spring did a fantastic job. And I have held judgment with Sam Levitt not being there. But, Joe, I can make the argument that their top four weapons on offense were held out the entire spring in Eugene Wilson and Sam Levitt and Tre'Davious Green, who was remotely not there. And to be completely blunt with you, there were times where they held out Winnie Watkins halfway through spring. And yet you still did that about what I think is going to be another top 30 defense for LSU. Joe, they're not – I mean, I think Harold Perkins's departure – is not a minus. I think it's a plus, because I think Deshaun Spears is much better equipped to fill the role of that star safety position than probably Harold Perkins was, because of the cover ability. I don't know where to put my thumb on them, and I've talked about them a lot clearly. But can they come together as a team? Because the question for me is not, do they have a boatload of talent? They have a boatload of talent. Offensively, I think they have one of the best staffs in the country. I think Blake Baker is an American gangster, an American stud. He took a team that was 108th in the country in total defense. Joe, they were 28th last year when Garrett Nussmeier, who was injured, allegedly, couldn't get past the 50-yard line. So what happens when Lane and company get in there? And it's not as if that you don't have the pieces. Now, you better get familiar with Richard Anderson, Lamar Brown, and Deuce Gerolds in the interior. The thing that worries me about them is when you throw out that much inexperience and youth in the interior of your defensive line, how do they perform? They're not a finished product, and they have holes, and I think depth is one of them. But if this team is to stay clean, Joe, they got more five stars and blue chips than anybody in the country, with a really good staff. So my question becomes, as we'll get to their schedule in a moment, how are they able to perform here?
That is my point that you're bringing up here. with the talent on this roster. There is, front to back, there are a lot of dudes that can go on to become top players at their positions in the country that can go on to become high draft picks. But I think that there is still a degree of development that needs to be had for some of these players.
I agree.
Lane Kiffin has been the type of coach that has gotten the most out of portal additions, especially. I do think you brought up a good part here, too, that was underrated about this, is that a lot of the big-name five-star guys that they recruited a couple of years ago and that have been growing and developing, DJ Pickett, Dominic McKinley, like there's just a lot of really good talent on this roster, on the defense especially, that those guys could be the breakout players for this team. Do you want me to read off their schedule so that we have the context here of this?
Yep.
Okay. I put in there should be wins. Louisiana Tech, I think that they're going to beat Clemson. I'm putting that in a should be win. I know that's a hard, that could be considered a hard game, but I don't think that's the case. Versus McNeese, I think that they're going to beat Auburn at Auburn first year under Golesh. And versus Arkansas, I don't think that Arkansas is going to be much of a challenge this year. I'm not threatened by Silverfield. The tough matchups that I think that they should win but are going to be hard, at Kentucky, I think Kentucky's going to be better than everybody thinks. And Mississippi State's also going to be better than everyone thinks. But this is where, I mean, you got to buy like two upsets in here if you want to go 9-3 and really shock everybody. At Ole Miss versus Texas A&M versus Alabama versus Texas at Tennessee. And I know that you've pointed out that you don't really feel threatened by Tennessee, but it's a road game at Tennessee in your first year.
I don't feel a new head coach. I don't feel threatened by them. They can't even get a quarterback. I do, however, look at that first month and say we're going to have so many answers about LSU in the Ole Miss, going to Ole Miss, which obviously we started the show off today about Lane Kiffin and how that – I mean, Joe, the game – call me a homer. The game of the year is LSU versus Ole Miss.
Yeah.
The game of the year, because of everything that's been going on
– well, Miami and Notre Dame will have actual playoff implications, but sure.
Joe, there's not a level of toxicity that can amount to that.
They're different types of games of the year.
Playoff implications. If Notre Dame already has a loss when they face Miami, then they got bigger problems.
I don't think it's going to be the case. I think it's going to be the winner of that game could be the number one team in the country.
Sounds good. That ain't got no implications based off of.
It's a different type of tone for these two games. Exactly. But I don't think that
game of the year is in Oxford in week three. But regardless, is LSU 2-2? Are they 3-1? Are they 4-0? Are they 1-3? You can make your argument for all of them.
Yeah.
And I really don't think, like, I could see them being 3-1. Texas, I think, is one of the toughest games that anybody can have. Tennessee doesn't worry me. They don't. They don't have, we've already talked about them. They don't worry me at all. I think Lane's going to find a way. He's going to find a way to beat Ole Miss or Tennessee. He ain't losing to both of them. It's not going to happen. And then the most Lane Kiffin thing of all would be finding a way to beat both of them. So I don't know what to make of LSU right now. I do think that we need to do another deep dive on them after camp is over with. Because, Joe, I can make the argument that you have a potential – well, potentially you have multiple first-round guys on that offense that weren't there a lot. Like, I can see Jordan Seaton going in the first round. I can see Harlan Berry going when it's his time to go in the first round. Yeah. I can see Tre'Davious Green going in the first round. Well, Tre'Davious Green was limited. So how am I supposed to determine how everything's supposed to look when their big signal caller's not there? I don't know.
It's,
I mean, what?
It's a good...
Let me ask you this before we get out of here. Does Lane Kiffin get out of Sam Leavitt what we saw against Texas in the playoffs?
I think that he can, and this is why that I've said when he was even on the radar, was who you needed to go after, him or Sorsby. His tools were very similar.
Thank God it wasn't Sorsby.
Jackson Dart. Yeah, and thank God it wasn't Sorsby. But there are a lot of similar tools between Leavitt and Dart, and Dart to the degree where he put his body on the line. I think Leavitt does the same thing, but to a fault. You know, he's been banged up. He's been very banged up.
Here's the thing for me. I think that offensive line is going to lean on people.
That's a big contingency for me. The O-line needs to step up.
Well, hold on now. You know that there's only been, like, of the 22 years Lane's called plays in college, You know, there's only been four where he hadn't had a 1,000-yard rusher. The biggest lie about Lane has been and always will be that they don't run the ball. So I digress. Yeah. All right. Any super chats in here? No?
No, none today.
Ole Miss fans yelling at me? Okay. I figured as much. Thank you to our partners over at 24/7 Sports. Go over there. Get 60% off your annual VIP membership by using the promo code RJ60. And until Wednesday, join our out of here. Good show, buddy.
Good show.
See y'all soon. Peace.